We talk about well-being a lot on this podcast, right? But one thing we don't really discuss all that often is financial well-being. And while it's a truism that money can't buy you happiness, we do also know that a lack of money can definitely get you quite a bit of sadness. I once saw this quote that I really liked that said, "Money can't buy you happiness, but it's much nicer to cry in a Mercedes than on a bicycle." In the only other money episode that we've had to date, back in episode 58 with Dr. Sam Burke, we talked about earning more money, how we value ourselves, and getting over that stigma that we tend to have as vets that money is a dirty word. But in this episode, we look at what to do with your money once you've earned it. So, personal financial management stuff, or to put it more bluntly, how not to piss away your money and be smart with it so you don't still have to be working 50-hour weeks when you're in your 50s just to break even on your expenses. And we have an amazing guest to enlighten us. If you're an Australian over, say, 30 years of age, then I don't have to introduce Noel Whittaker. For everyone else, Noel Whittaker is one of the world's foremost authorities on personal finance. He's an international best-selling author, finance and investment expert, radio broadcaster, newspaper columnist, and public speaker. Noel reaches over 3 million readers each week with his columns in major Australian newspapers and magazines, and also broadcasts on over 50 radio stations. He has over 20 best-selling books, including a brand new one called 10 Simple Steps to Financial Freedom. His first book, Making Money Made Simple, set sales records across the country and was named in the 100 most influential books of the 20th century. I read a statistic somewhere that at one point, more than something like 60% of Australian homes had a copy of that book on the shelf. For 30 years, Noel was the director of Whittaker McNaught, one of Australia's leading financial advisory companies, with more than
$1 million.
Sorry, that's $2 billion under management. In 1988, Noel was named Australian Investment Planner of the Year, and in 2003, he was awarded the Australian Centenary Medal in recognition of his services to the financial services industry. In 2011, he was made a member of the Order of Australia for service to the community in raising awareness of personal finance. He's currently an adjunct professor and executive in residence with the Queensland University of Technology, as well as a committee member advising the Australian Securities and Investment Commission. So basically, what I'm trying to say is sit up and pay attention. I do just have to tell you a quick story here about how this episode actually happened. I mean, how does a little niche podcast for vets get Noel freaking Whittaker on the show? If you listen to our previous episode, you'll know that I do my clinical work at one of the AAS hospitals up here on the Sunshine Coast. But in addition to my clinical work, I also do a private podcast for AAS team members, where we interview team members and have conversations about the stuff that impacts us and matters to us. It's pretty cool. And then Rob Webster, who you'll know as our ECC guru over on the clinical podcast, and who is the CEO of AAA, had this idea of doing a series on personal finance, recognizing that if we're trying to improve the team's well-being, that one factor that will play a big factor in their overall, let's call it happiness, is how financially fit they are. Which makes sense because let me tell you that if the number of after-hour shifts someone does is determined primarily by their level of debt rather than their level of enthusiasm, not an ideal scenario. So we decide we want to get a financial advisor on the podcast and have a Q&A session where anyone from the team can ask all of their burning money questions. And for ages, I'm contacting advisors and asking, do you want to come on our podcast? And I'm racking my brain and not getting anywhere. And then one day, I have a conversation with this guy called James Whittaker. Shout out to James and his excellent podcast, Win the Day, who was leading a podcasting mastermind that I was a part of. And I suddenly remember that he said one day that his dad was some sort of finance guy. Now remember that I'm not Australian, so I'm a bit oblivious. So I go, hey James, do you reckon your dad would want to join us on this session that I'm planning for my work? And he says, sure, I'll send him a text. Next thing, Noel Whittaker texts me and he says, sure, I'll just come to your house one day. And I'm like, yeah, you should stay for lunch. It'll be fun. And then I start preparing and I Google Noel Whittaker and I'm like, oh, okay. So there we go. This conversation was so cool. And the feedback from the team at AA was that the content could literally be life-changing, which sounds like an overstatement, but it's not. So I asked Rob and the guys who joined us to ask their questions. Shout out to Drs. Hannah Davies, DeHanna Ho, Brooke Shampers, Luke Verbaten, and Dr. Rob himself, if they'd be happy if we shared this to the wider vet world. And here we are. So listen, enjoy, and then please act on it. And then one day, when you're rich, you can buy me a beer and you can say, that episode with Noel Whittaker changed my life. Two quick shout outs before we jump in. On the previous episode, we had an ad for a vet job at AAS up here at the Tanawa Clinic where I work. If you missed it and you are curious about a career in emergency, or you want to check whether your reasons for thinking that emergency is not for you are valid, jump back to the last 5 or 10 minutes of our episode with Kate and Cam. So that's episode number 83 for all of the details. And then if you do decide to stop amateuring your financial life and start acting on the advice in this episode, head to Noel's website, noelwhittaker.com, for a range of spectacular resources, including his new book on personal finance. I've been playing with the retirement calculator and the compound interest calculator to see if I can use the one to affect the other. He also has a great newsletter to slowly bring your level of financial literacy up towards your level of knowledge on how to fix sick animals. Okay, let's jump in with Noel Whittaker.
Noel, it is just an absolute privilege to get to meet you. I was away when Hugh texted and said who was going to be here. And I've just got to share, I guess you get this all the time, but I was a fairly no-hoping vet student, and I actually stole this book off my future father-in-law's bookshelf.
Right.
And it was one of the first books I ever read on some of the concepts of money, business, and personal development. So I'm sure it's probably not one of the ones you, if for everyone who can't see the title, it's called Getting It Together, and it's a book by Noel for young teenagers. And it was probably the best thing my father-in-law could have left on his shelf for me to steal for the good of his daughter, because it really was a huge changing book. And yeah, just an awesome privilege to be here, Noel. And I'm hoping we've got a group of about 400 young people in the emergency group. And if you could help, you know, everyone here has got awesome questions, but if you could help, you know, 1, 2, 10, or 20 young vets, nurses, or client care representatives make that decision that you helped me make to become an investor, that would be beyond valuable for the people in this group. And I might add that the guys here with us today, I think they've all made that shift already, and there's some pretty bright sparks here to grill you today. So
that's awesome.
I hope you're ready for some questions.
That book has changed its name to Beginner's Guide to Wealth because the title was ambiguous. And then James, my son, co-wrote the sequel to that book. It's the same book with a bit more in it. And he sort of added a bit more for young people and stuff. But basically, it's about life's principles. And one of them is the only way to succeed is to fail. And most people don't get that, you know? If you don't fail, you'd never stretch yourself.
Does that hold true for finances as well, Noel? Because we don't really feel like failing financially too hard.
You don't want to walk into a lion's cage without armor on, do you? I mean, there's degrees of that.
Right, I'm going to kick off because it's my house, so I get to ask the first question.
Okay.
And then we'll take it from there. Okay. Noel, so you wrote Making Money Made Easy, the first edition.
When was it? First mistake. It's not Making Money Made Easy, it's Simple. And Simple and Easy are very, very different.
Okay, that's
Making
my question.
Making Money Made Simple. Okay. So and it's very simple.
What's the difference between easy and simple, first of all?
Well, for example, it's simple to say you must walk for 1 mile a day. Mm-hmm. But that may not be easy if you're lazy. That's why I try to make investment happen automatically. Okay. Automatically.
I think that's an important point. It's simple, but it's not easy. You still have to do it.
Look, I'm writing a book now for young people called 10 Simple Steps to Financial Freedom. The first chapter is spend less than you earn. 80% of people can't do it. There's nothing hard about becoming wealthy. It really isn't. But you've got to do what you got to do. That's all. If you got a dog, you got to walk it every day. If you got a dog, you got to feed it. You got to feed it the right things. But that's not, it's simple. Not hard to learn.
It's a paradigm shift because a lot of people want easy, right? We want the quick fix. We want the easy. We want the make money quickly, get rich quickly and easily.
Look, we all want the 14-day lose 10K diet, you know, the MBA in 10 minutes, the big muscles, you know. Doesn't work like that. That's the paradox. Everything worthwhile takes time. And money growing by its nature is a slow process. And like all success principles, it's slow to start and most people give up. I've been going for a year. Nothing's happened after a year. Well, sorry about that. It's like a uni course, you know. You don't learn to be a vet in 6 months. So all progress that's important takes time, but it's also slow to start. But it gets better and better as time goes on. That's the essence of it.
We can almost stop there. That's the first message. My question, Noel, was going to be, so that book you wrote in, no, when was
87.
It? 87, yeah. And then you had a revised version later. Has anything drastically changed if you had to rewrite that book now? Has anything drastically changed or what has changed in your advice?
I have rewritten the book in detail. And the reason was I found out that information by itself is useless. You need an action plan. So the new book is the same stuff, but it resolves around an action plan. But also what's a bit scary, there is a major economic difference. And that was before the woke times. In that book in 87, I said, if the average couple on the average income bought the average house and used her wage just for the mortgage, in 5 years, they're debt-free. Now, rates were 15% then. Now, the same book says the average couple on the average wage by the average house, in 10 years, the debt can be controlled on one income, with interest rates at 4%. And that shows how much relatively dearer houses have got. In 1974, the average Brisbane house was about 30 grand. That was 2 years' wages. Jeez. Now it's maybe 8 or 9 years' wages.
Yeah, that's massive.
It is. Yeah. It is. It is.
All right, guys, over to you guys. Questions. Who's going to be first?
Come on, someone's got to start me, as the auctioneer says. Come on, doesn't matter.
So I guess one of my first questions was, you were mentioning about the economic times recently. How would you recommend people taking advantage of the recession that's about to come?
Well, I started my business in 1974 building spec houses, and I was too stupid to know there was a recession on. You know, I think you've got to control what you can, but don't worry about what you can't. Pets will get sick. Pets will get treatment. I mean, you guys should be in a recession-proof business, as far as I can see. Yeah. In fact, I think, as we all know, in COVID, the price of pets doubled because people had pets instead. So I think you guys are in a recession-proof business. See, what you can, you start, there's a recession coming. What do I do? Things will get bad. You just keep on doing it. You just keep on doing it.
Luke, were you asking more in terms of personal finance, though, in terms of personal investment, or what do you do with the money? Because Luke's not the business owner, so
that's all right.
He's just because a wage agent.
Everything I own goes straight to Rob for the company. So I really didn't say much of that. So I guess it's more, for us. When there's a recession, there's less money that the general public would have with the interest rates rising. So what are some of the tricks or that you would recommend, preparing for worst case scenario? Hopefully you don't have to, we won't be in that worst case scenario, but what would be some of the recommendations that you get, going to keep for families and everything that's for expected hard times, I guess?
Okay, first question, is there any way you can improve your skills? If you can improve your skills, and I don't know the answer, But if you can improve your skills, A, you can improve your income. And secondly, can you improve your services? The money's in the extra products you can sell. As we all know, is there an extra product you can ethically sell? That's the way you do it. Because if you can increase your sales without increasing your costs, the effect on your bottom line is massive. So A, improve your skills if you can, because that improves your income. But secondly, can your business offer other services? Like I know when we had a dog, our dog died now, but every month the vet would send a text that's due for some needle or something. Now, it was only the text from the vet that got me going back there. Oh, the poor dog, it needs the needle. So I think that's your focus.
Yep.
That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're in specifically this group, in a slightly different situation because it is an emergency hospital.
Yeah.
So we don't send reminders.
Hey, oh, no, okay.
You come in when you need us.
Yes, you do.
And then you mentioned the word ethically. That is an issue. You don't want to oversell services. No. We've got to do what we need to do to get the best outcomes.
But also, if my dog got hit by a car, is it hard to reach you people? Because my own mind is, oh, gee, where's the vet? Are they going to be there? How long am I going to wait? You know, so I think, again, you've got to make it easy to do business with you. And I think that's one of the major principles. And most people don't do that. Now, if you phone anybody now, you know what will happen. By the time you press button one and button two and press three, then there's recording saying, unusually high volume of calls, of course. Oh, it's hopeless. Hopeless. But, you know, people starve for human touch.
Is there anything that you would recommend at the home, like in the home, finances and other things, just to like, you know, better prepare themselves?
Well, if you've got a mortgage, try and bring your home down to a 15-year term. That'll save you all this interest. And that's about $8 a thousand a month. So if you've got a $400,000 loan, about $3,200 will bring your loan down. It'll give you a safety buffer if rates increase, and you'll pay it back if they don't. And the word is this morning that rates will do this. I was talking to a guy who knows people in the Reserve Bank, and he was telling me that they want to go bang, bang, bang quickly, but quickly.
Yeah.
Instead of going little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit, bang, 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 then stop and start going down again. Because what they want to do is scare people. They don't want to send people broke. They want to scare them.
Scare them to do what? What's the motivation? Well,
this is the crazy part about it. I mean, they talk about inflation, but inflation's out of our control. I mean, I'll still need petrol. I'll still need groceries. It's a worldwide problem.
So they want to scare us to spend less? Or?
Spend less, okay. Yes.
Okay.
Which can be very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So I guess with that inflation being so high, at the moment, like last month, I think the CPI was like 5.1% for Australia. It was like, I think 9.1% came out in America.
That's last night. That's right, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, with this such high inflation rates, where would you recommend people keeping their money? Because in the banks, it's losing money. Would you recommend like an inflation hedge against like commodities like gold or anything of that nature?
No way. No. Yep. Look, you've only got cash, property, and shares.
Yeah. Right?
That's your three places. If you've got a loan, an offset account's a great place. If you've got a housing loan, offset account will pay you what the loan's charging. So a guaranteed 4.2 tax for free in the offset account. Plus you've got the ability to withdraw it if you need it. In your superannuation, how old are you?
I'm 30.
Okay, well, you can put money into super as a tax deduction. Only thing is you can't touch it till you're 60. So,
yeah.
I've got one more big question on.
Here we go. I love the big ones.
No. Well, this is on Luke's behalf because Luke is an investor. We talk investments a lot, and he invests currently in shares.
Not in crypto, surely.
In crypto. He's not in crypto. He's under 30.
Oh, well. Don't you love it? The bigger Phil theory. Yeah.
Luke's been looking at buying a house in Brisbane for how long, Luke? For a couple of years now. And so Luke hasn't bought that house, and the lady behind him, Deanna Ho, did buy a house in Brisbane, and as you know, they're both pretty switched on investors, and Deanna's house has appreciated quite significantly in value. Yep. The question Luke hasn't asked yet is, should he go and buy a house in Brisbane at this point of the market, Noel? And he's a 30-year-old with significant income and some investments and some cash.
Great.
I know you can't give him specific advice, but some thoughts would be much appreciated.
Okay, let's get one thing very clear. There is no such thing as the housing market. It's absolute bullshit. Do you mean Cairns or Quilpie or Perth or Point Piper? Houses, units or what? So you first of all need to work out the market that you want to be in. Is that Cooperoo or Everton Park or Windsor or Inala, you know? So I think the first thing you need to do is work out how much you can borrow. And the key to success in real estate is you buy well and you add value. That's why apartments are normally a terrible investment, because you can't add value to one. And you add value by location or by getting a house that you can do up cheaply. So I think he needs to work out how much he can afford to spend. Then can he get what he wants in that price range? Because location is the ultimate in property. Location and the value add. That makes sense?
Yeah. The question still that I've often wondered about, and especially the younger guys, like, so I'm a homeowner. That ship has sailed for me. But do you go, well, let me park my money in a home, or do I see more growth in a share market? So we'll keep renting, but invest my spare money in shares. I'm sure that the equation will shift depending on the market. If it's not a simple answer, is there a way to determine what's the most sensible strategy?
It's pretty well clear that the optimum is to rent and invest in an index fund. But most people won't do it. Like, I bought a place down the coast, an apartment, for $500,000 in 1990. I sold it recently for $1 million. In an index fund, that would have been $11 million.
Really?
But see, I wouldn't have put $500,000 in shares in 1990. See, people don't do that. So I think for the average person, you're better off to buy a house and you've got something, and then borrow against the house for an index fund. Because the index funds average 9% per annum for 120 years. It can't go broke. It's paying 4.5% franked. And the cost is bugger all. That's the easy way out.
Noel, could you explain for some of the team who might not know what an index fund is, what it is and why it's so cheap to invest in?
Okay, there's a thing called the stock market, right? That's about 3,000 companies, of which most don't trade. So you've got about 200 or 300 companies which make up the real stock exchange. That's your Westpac, your Commonwealth Bank, Harvey Norman, JB Hi-Fi, Rio, Telstra, you know, da-da-da-da-da. When you buy the index, you're buying every horse in that race. Your basket contains every share in the top 200 or 300. It can't go broke. It's just a statistic. It can't go broke. It will do this and this and this. And that's all it is. And there's no decisions to make. Instead of trying to pick this and trying to pick that, you know, we've all had winners and losers. Once you try and pick, it's like horses. Oh, the good ones and the bad ones. But for the average person, the index is so simple.
Yeah, because emotionally there's that, you look at the growth rate and you go, oh, that's so slow. But if I can pick a winner, I can double my money.
I know. I bought Magellan shares at a dollar. I bought 50 grand at a dollar. They went to 70 bucks.
Well,
I sold a couple million dollars at 70. I've still got 18,000 left. They've gone from 30 to 12. In the last year, but I've still got 360 grand's worth for my 56,000 investment. So am I happy or unhappy? I'm saying so. But that was a lucky shot. I'd like to know how to do it again.
Yeah.
That's the trouble.
So then how would you recommend the beginners, the first timers that have never really touched investment before to go about investing in the S&P 500 or your index funds?
Well, the index fund, the code's STW, Sierra Tango W, whatever W is. It's an ASX fund. You just buy it like a BHP share. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
Which means you can buy $1,000 worth. I bought an apartment in Morningside for my old aunt, who's, because she was sort of getting old, and I promised a tenancy until she died. That was 20 years ago, and she's now 93 and still going strong. That's gone from 216 to 400 in that time. Having got to 500, it's coming down again because apartments get old. That same money in the index would be $1.2 million. You see what I mean? That's my view. But the next thing is, when she dies, I'm going to sell it. We'll be up for $100,000 in capital gains tax because I can't sell the front stairs. If that was a $1.2 million share portfolio, I could sell $20,000 or $30,000 or leave it be. And that's the flexibility of shares. The thing about shares is there's no land tax, there's no rates, there's no maintenance, there's no vacancies. You know, it's just easy. Do you understand franked dividends?
Definitely not everyone in our group will understand franked dividends. Before we move on, because Dee is a share market investor, and she counsels Luke not to buy any more cryptocurrency frequently.
That's good.
Because she says it doesn't earn an income, so he's wasting his time. But if you could explain a little bit about franked dividends and why they can be so powerful as well.
I don't have a blackboard, but every time I make a speech to retirees, I ask the question, not one of them understands franked dividends. So to keep it very simple, company tax is 30%. You get a credit for the tax the company's paid. So if your company makes $1 million, it pays $300,000 in company tax, can give you $700,000 back as a dividend. Are you with me so far? Okay. Yeah. So let's to keep it simple, say it's a $700 check you've got back. With a franking credit attached worth $300 to pay you for the tax the company has paid. That is value because you can get it back or use it. So it's taxable. So you've only got $700 in the bank, but you got a credit for $300 with it. Now, if you're earning about $120,000 a year, the tax on that will be, what, about 34%, won't it? So you have to add the franking credit. So you only bank $700, but your credit's $300, so you pay tax on $1,000. The tax on $1,000 at 34.5 is $345. The credit is $300. You only pay $45 tax on your dividend of $700. Yeah. Now, let's say you've got a $200,000 share portfolio returning, keep it simple, 5% growth and 4% income. The capital gains does not trigger until you sell. So you can spend the next 30 or 40 years building up with no tax. So your $200,000 has just given you $9,000 back, $100,000. The $100,000's growth isn't taxable. $4,000's franked, taxable lightly. So you've just cracked $9,000 improvement in the portfolio and the taxes bugger all. That's why share investing is so simple for you guys. You can just build. Now that makes sense. Does that make sense? Because most people don't get this.
I don't 100% understand how it works, but I know it works. That's right.
You get a check plus an attachment. Yeah. You pay tax on the combined value of what you got plus the credit, less the credit.
Well, hey, just work a little hard. Make so much money, need a 10-ton truck. Well, ha 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 ha.
My question is for those beginner investors or even investors itself, like, would you normally, because I dollar cost average whenever I invest, but I guess the argument for a lot of people is like, do you invest small portions but consistently and regularly, or do you accumulate a certain number before going into the stock market? That's always the debate with a lot of investors.
I think the regular one is the way to go. One of the great keys is you don't miss what you don't get. We spend what we get, most people. You just put a direct debit for $2,000 every month into super. It's tax deductible. You won't miss it. In 30 years' time, that's a couple of million. But it happens automatically. I had a photographer come around once to home. Oh, I can't save. I said, okay, you invest 1 gig a week. Oh, all right. It worked for him. You've got to make sure that part of your income is taken away from you automatically.
So you said that automatic payment into super. So share buying, like what Dee's asking, do the same thing. Buy a little bit of shares
automatic
every month or every, instead of saving.
Yeah.
And is that purely a psychological thing? Is it because otherwise you're going to have 20K sitting in your bank account that's earmarked for shares, and then you suddenly go, oh, or I could buy a new car.
Look, every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 o'clock in the morning, my personal trainer comes to my house. If he didn't come, I wouldn't train. You know, but human beings are inherently lazy. There's always a reason not to do it, but you don't miss what you don't get. The only, not trick, but the fact is that super's deductible. If you're not going to super, it's coming out of after-tax dollars. That's the difference. Once you start doing it, you'll be amazed how it builds. You get your credit card statement. When the credit card statement comes, what do you think? What do you think when the credit card statement comes? It happens to me every month.
Can't believe I spent so much.
Exactly. I get this. I said to my wife, you've spent $4,000, but it's like it's $220 and $230 and the groceries and there's nothing on it. But it's $4,000 or $5,000. But investing works the same way. I like RAIZ. I like RAIZ. I think RAIZ is fantastic.
Is there a minimum amount that you advise to invest? Because you know how with stock markets, depending on what platform you use, there is broker costs and broker fees and things like that. Is there a certain percentage of like investments like broker fees that you'll take into consideration before investing? Like, for example, if the broker fees is around $10, you know, there's no point investing anything less than, you know, like just say 2,000.
I agree with that. I agree with that. But I don't know this, but I thought there's online things that are very cheap, aren't there? Aren't there online things, ComSec or something? Anyone use ComSec? Oh. I don't know what they charge, but I don't think they
Luke
charge
will
much.
Know.
Luke?
ComSec's like $20 per transaction fee.
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so the other ones are like, you know, you can get, Staked or Trading or something, you can get down to like $10 that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But ComSec's about $20 per trade.
Okay. But don't get caught into an annual fee. I mean, I struck a woman, the broker was charging $1,000 a month. Oh, that's horrendous. And you pay on the transaction.
Yeah. You mentioned RAIZ. What's RAIZ? I don't know that.
It's the old Acorns. RAIZ, it lets you, cryptocurrency too if you want it, it lets you choose a portfolio and it'll take it out of your bank all the time for you. RAIZ is just such a lovely learning experience.
Okay.
Have a look.
All right, great.
Yeah,
and there's also Spaceship as well.
Spaceship.
I don't know Spaceship. Is it similar?
Yeah, it's pretty similar, but for the first $5,000, there's no fees for the first $5,000.
Okay. Yeah.
But okay. It's the same principle.
Okay.
They're all micro-investing platforms, yeah.
Good morning, Brooke. Brooke's joining us from Melbourne.
Hi, Brooke.
Hello. Everyone in my family is so excited that I get to speak to you.
Oh, that's so funny.
Mum and Dad get your emails every week and they always send them to me to read.
Isn't that nice? You should sign up for yourself. It's free.
I should. I really should.
Hannah hasn't said a word.
I know. She's listening and learning. So who's going to go, Brooke or Hannah? Hannah, you've been waiting patiently. You should have a question for us.
Yeah, my question, I know you can't give like personal finance advice, but my question is, so I'm 23 and I've been a vet for just over a year. So I've only just started in my like earning capacity per se. And so you were talking about cash versus super.
Shares or property.
Property, yeah, yeah.
Cash shares property, yeah.
Cash shares property. Like, which one would you start in? Because if I'm trying to save for a house deposit and you're a single person, I'm trying to decide, you know, like I only earn so much. Where do I put it?
Well, every asset class has a purpose, right? And shares and property are long-term investments. Cash is more a 3 to 5 year investment. So saving for a house, cash has to be in the bank.
Yeah.
Now, I know there's a thing you can access part of your super and take it out again. There's a way you can boost your savings a little bit by putting money into super and getting it back. It's a little bit complex, though. I'm not sure if it's worth the effort, to be honest. But the main thing is, the first thing's a goal. It all starts with your goal. So the first thing is, okay, I want to buy a house. How much do I want to spend? And how much do I need to save up for it? And what resources have I got available? Is there help from my parents or not? You know, is there a part-time job? So in other words, once you set the goal, that'll get your mind going.
Yeah. So say you decided you want to buy a house and you set your goal. Should you also invest, like put a bit of money in the share market as well at the same time?
I think at your age, you've got to focus on the goal.
Okay.
Once you've got your house deposit, and once you've bought the house, that's when you can think further.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Can I jump in on that? Sorry, Brooke, you'll be next. But the next question then is, that's more my stage in life. Now you have the house. Now you have the mortgage with the interest payments on it. Do you try and smash that mortgage and then start looking at shares? Or is it both at the same time? Do you go, well, let me aim for, like you said, a 15 years paying off the mortgage. Yeah. And then if you have spare, also invest in the share market? Or do you focus all of it to try and get rid of the debt? I like the emotional feeling of being debt-free, of saying, well, I want to get rid of the debt, which is a sensible approach.
But you need to understand the importance of time. How much you have at 50, 60, 70, 80, whatever, depends on the rate you can achieve and the length of time. If you're 55 with $500,000 in super, if you can delay retirement till age 60, you get 40% more. Because I tell the story of the lily in the pond. A lily in a pond starts as a tiny speck and doubles every day. How long to go from quarter full to full? 2 days. Quarter full to half on the 9th, half to full on the 10th. If that 10-day frame is your investment journey, and you've got to stop and harvest on the 8th, you've missed out on 3/4 of what you could have had. See, every time your money doubles, there's more growth in the last doubles than all the other doubles. 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 8,000, 16,000. So you need time. And that's why it's so important, once you've got your mortgage under control, is then invest as well. Because you need to get that capital sum growing. Because the extra 5 years makes a massive difference.
So quantify or clarify getting your mortgage under control. Yeah. What does an under control mortgage look like?
Well, I think $8 a thousand is fine.
Oh, what you said earlier, okay.
If you can pay back $8 a thousand a month.
Mm-hmm. And then you invest anything extra.
Yeah. And you can invest by a loan to buy shares or just investing everything in shares.
Because my instinct at the moment, especially, again, what Luke said, interest rates going up, so now I'm panicking, going, I need to put more money into the mortgage. It's that compound. So I look at the short-term returns on the share market versus what my interest rates are, and that makes me panic. But I think that's a paradigm shift, what you just said there, is don't focus on the short-term returns, focus on that long-term
return. And remember I said, get the highest effective rate of return possible, If you focus on your mortgage, you're getting the mortgage rate.
Yeah.
Maybe 4-5. Yeah. Shares, you should get 9. But you want to make sure that you're comfortable. You never want to be forced to dump shares at the worst time.
See, I should have had this conversation 15 years ago.
I hear that so often.
These guys are 15 years ago, so great.
That's all right. They're fine.
So what about with people with hex debts? So like for me, I've finished uni a few years ago and I've got a hex debt of, say, $50,000, $60,000 with an interest rate of about 3% or keeping up with inflation and everything. Would you try and pay that off as soon as possible, or would you just let that come out of your tax and just focus on the investments?
Yeah, I think a debt that big, I'd let it pay itself off. I had a letter recently for the paper. He only had 18 grand. I said, well, if it's 18 grand, pay it off. But I think if it's as big as 50, I wouldn't like to lose that much invested capital your age.
So don't rush to pay that off. Same principle.
No, well, it's a choice.
Yeah.
If I've got the 50 grand in my hand now, do I pay off the hex debt or invest it? I'd say invest it.
Okay. Dr. Brooke, what have you got for us?
So following along with the mortgage trend, where is it better to have the money when you're paying off a mortgage? In the offset or actually in the mortgage and paying down the mortgage?
In the offset account.
In the offset.
And I'll tell you one good reason why, which isn't often talked about. It means you can take the money if you need it. Secondly, a lot of people buy a cheap house to start, then they want to keep it. And they say to me, can I take a loan to buy the dream house because it's paid off? But you can't. So you're paying tax on the rents of the house you're keeping. But just hypothetically, if there was a $400,000 house with a $400,000 loan and you reach a stage where the offset is $400,000, the effective debt is zero. Mm-hmm. Now you want to buy your dream home. You withdraw the money from the offset, that's $400,000 as a deposit on the dream home, leaving the first home totally geared. Okay. It's a much more effective way tax-wise.
Okay, that's awesome.
I just have a clarifying question just to ask Noel as well. When you say totally geared and tax-effective, could you just explain the difference between the interest that we're paying on our, you know, primary place of residence versus the investment property now that we've just moved on.
For the interest to be deductible, it must be for the purpose of buying the income producing asset. So if you buy a loan for your own home and then you pay it off because it wasn't deductible, it's now a debt-free home. If you borrow against that home to buy your dream home, the purpose is for a private purpose. It's not deductible. But if you own a property, then it changes character. I'm now going to move out of my negatively geared own home and go to a new home. The loan becomes deductible again. All right?
Meaning that the interest that you're paying on that home, because it's a source of income, comes off your tax bill.
Yes. Right? Yeah. But only because the loan, it's the original loan. Yeah. You cannot borrow against that house for the purpose of your own house. That makes sense?
Anybody else? Who's next? More questions?
So is it worth it to avoid going into the upper tax bracket to salary sacrifice into super as a lump sum before the end of the year if you realize you are heading towards that upper tax bracket? Should you dump some of your money into super pretty quickly to avoid being taxed at a higher rate? Is it worth copping the extra tax and keeping the extra money, or putting the money in super and paying less tax?
Next principle. Every decision has good points and bad points. Every decision, right? How old are you?
I'm 27.
Okay. The advantage is you get a tax deduction, right? That you lose 15% going in, but that's it. But that money is now untouchable for the next 40 years.
Yeah.
So the price of the tax saving now is losing the money for 40 years. That's all. I've got no trouble with that. I mean, I think it's great to be able to build up your super, but you must understand. Maybe another option would be to borrow for investment, getting the $10,000 as a tax deduction for interest, except that the income from what you buy would negate it. I also think that tax brackets are going to happen. I feel the Labor government's going to increase the taxes on you guys. It's one of those things, there's no certain answer. That's all.
My next question is, just want to get your opinion, because I always like to dig into every investor's mindset in this part.
That's awesome.
Hypothetically, that's all awesome. Right?
Yes.
Hypothetically, if the interest rate goes up by, say, 10%, in that instance, if, like, I'll ask you about what you are at your current state, like in your age and at the moment, what are your first three moves? If the interest rate goes up by 10%, what is the first three things that you're going to do when it comes to either your cash flow, your investment property, or yourself?
Okay, if rates go up by 10, which won't happen, half the homes will be foreclosed. It'll be an absolute catastrophic property debacle because everyone will lose their houses. It's not going to happen.
Okay.
All right. I think it's a true psychological thing. Most people worry about what isn't going to happen and don't worry about what is going to happen. That makes sense. If you got good health insurance and income replacement insurance and trauma insurance, see, it's more unlikely that you'll get I'm not being personal here.
No.
Likely you'll get cancer, stroke, heart attack than rates will go to 10%.
Okay.
Well, it's almost if we average it long enough, isn't it? It's almost a certainty that you'll get cancer, stroke or a heart attack at some stage.
Sure.
Whereas the other is a hypothetical. But I can see by the look in their eyes, both Hannah and Luke are hanging for this period where the rates go up and all the houses are foreclosed.
Well, I can see that and jump in
and buy it, you know.
Of course, if that happened, no one could afford a loan and rents would go sky high. Rents would go sky high because no one could afford a house. They probably couldn't afford to pay rent either.
I remember when the rates were 15%, I put my money in a term deposit. So
I
was only 15.
We were speaking about like insurances. So like income protection, TPD, trauma, and we talk about life insurance. Are you one to consider insurance? Because you know how superannuation, super companies, they also offer insurance, the same ones that we have. Would you recommend people at our age, the 20s, the 30s, is it better to take these kind of insurances through our super, or is it better to take it in a separate company, like third-party companies? Like,
okay.
What's your take?
Okay. If the insurance is deductible, like income replacement, you pay that personally because you want the tax deduction for it. If it's life insurance or death or TPD, which is non-deductible, take it inside super because your contributions are tax deductible. So non-deductible insurance inside super and deductible in your own name or your own business entity. Just be very careful. If you change super funds, you may lose your insurance. Well, possibly. There's a case at the moment, a guy was dying with cancer. He had a $400,000 life policy and his wife, to save fees, amalgamated his super and lost his life insurance. These were older people, but still, these things happen.
Hannah, how are you feeling? Are you feeling inspired or overwhelmed? You're like, oh,
well, I'm trying to keep it simple. I'm doing my best. Yeah. It's a big topic.
It's good. It's good. Yeah. It's good to have some sort of financial education because, like, you don't get any of that in school. So
I've got a new book coming out in 8 weeks called 10 Simple Steps to Financial Freedom, written for young vets, young uni students. It's only 120 pages in 10 chapters.
Perfect.
Right.
And that's 10 things you must do, right? And number one is you spend less than you earn, because 80% of people don't.
I'm sitting here looking at the group of people we've got here. And everyone here is an investor already. And
that's God, great. That's awesome. Yeah.
They're bloody young. So
that's great. They've got time on their side.
Wait, hang on.
Well, my question is, there are, you know, another 390 of us in the organization, many of whom are not yet investors. And I don't know if you could, you know, you've been around a long time and you've seen a lot of people's financial situations and their quality of their lives. Is there anything you can share with us that helps explain the absolute importance of making that shift? You know, the tactics will come over time, but that actual spend less than you earn and invest something, it changed my life forever. But you've seen this happen for a lot of people, and I'd love you to potentially explain why that's just so important a decision to make.
It starts with desire. You know, Think and Grow Rich was the book that changed my life. Number one is desire. And some people haven't got it. That's why we say you hire attitude and teach skills. You can never teach attitude. Attitude's something you hire, I think. You know, there are doers and there are not doers.
Are we all done, guys? Have you got more questions? Or are we starting
I have a few more. Actually.
Okay, go deep.
Where you go?
Okay, so I guess like when it comes to financial mindset, because I think a few people that I know or I've spoken to, the mindset is always like, you know, how it, a lot of people go like, especially the new investors at this moment, probably listening to this podcast in future, they always have the mindset of it is probably too late to. How do we get ourselves out of that? Because like how you say, you can never teach attitude, but what pearls of wisdom can we get from today, especially for those people who haven't started investing yet, no matter what stage of your life, how is it that before you find yourself saying it is too late to do something, you know, change that mindset?
I get that from 80-year-olds as well. I mean, it's never too late to make the best of what you've got. Young people have got the precious thing, time. I don't have time. I can't buy time. Once 24 hours ago, it's gone. Like, you've got all that time for compounding to work. Understand the power of compounding. You need that sense, I need to start. And if they, as I said, it's got to be automatic. Every day you do something. It's so easy not to. But by having it automatically happen, makes it work.
Yeah, I think the reason we don't sometimes, or certainly personally, is if you don't feel in control, then it's really scary. Like you don't want to look what's hiding in the forest because you head in the sand sort of an approach. It's scary to start because you're worried about, well, everybody else is so far ahead of me, or I don't know what I'm doing or anything like that. But I think exactly that, just saying, well, face that initial hurdle and...
But there are some people in their life who always want to talk about it, but not do anything. You must have struck that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to talk about it. Just do it.
Yeah.
You know, do it. You know, as we say, the longest journey starts with one step. If you never make the first step, you'll never make the journey. You got to start.
Okay. So I'm 32. I don't have kids. But I guess, like, this is for parents or future parents. Like, what do you think is the first step if they want to consider investing for their children's future right now? I mean, like, we know it's never better than today to do it.
Okay, you don't want to stop kids helping themselves. Hmm. I think as parents, your first job is to get your own finances under control. That's the first thing. Then you teach your kids. Now, my daughter has on her fridge is the kids' jobs for the week. And how much they get for those jobs. You know, you've got to teach the kids the value of work. And I think that's how you start. You instill in them the principles. Because these days they don't see cash. They see you go to the bank, you know, the ATM and stick in the card and pay for yourself. Or they see you swipe your phone. Kids aren't used to seeing exchange anymore. You always get back to basic principles. You walk your dog and you feed it well. It's basic principles, you know. That makes sense.
Yep.
In most of these things, there are no simple answers to many questions, but there are to some.
At what point would you start salary sacrificing to super?
Well, again, when you're ready to lose that money till you're 60, I think. But it's a nice way to build a nest egg. And you can put in 27.5 grand a year as a tax deduction, 27,500 as a tax deduction. That includes from all sources, you know. It's a nice way to get going.
So if you say when you're ready, do you mean mentally and emotionally ready, or is it, well, I have some money spare at the end of the month?
It's one of these things, I think it's a good thing. Because in 10 years' time, you're going to have $500,000. When you're 40, you'll have $500,000 in super. And that'll be more than most people. And you'll learn to take care of it and watch it and tend it. And nice thing to have.
So as soon as you have the money spare to do it, it's a good idea, yeah?
Because the danger is otherwise we waste it. I'll buy a new handbag, I'll go for a trip, have a night out, you know. All of a sudden it goes. But put in your 27.5 or 2,000 a month, and then that's done. That's a nice foundation will be there for you. And if you get a relationship, then it breaks up. It's one thing that the guy will find hard to get his hands on.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
What about, so you say, like, you know, 2,000 is, like, you know, a good start to play, invest a month. What about for those that have very little fat at the end of the month to invest? Would you then, say, recommend keeping to Raise or Spaceship or something of that nature? What about the people who don't have as much money to invest in as other people?
Then I think you change your mindset and you decide how much a month you need to invest, then cut your cloth and cut your expenses, and that should be your first investment. If you need $2,000 a month to invest, you put it in there first. If that means you don't have a beer, you don't have a beer. If you don't have avocados or something, you know. Because it's human nature to spend what we get. So 99% of people will say, I got nothing left to invest. But once you take the money out of the stuff, oh, we still do it. I had a restaurant too came to me, very, very successful. You can't save. I said, okay, I want $2,000 a month for you and your wife into super every month as a tax deduction. No contract. Oh, can't do it. Do it. 3 months later, gee, I'm doing it. 12 months later, I was doing it. 4 years later, I've got $600,000 there. You know, if you bought a car, you'd pay it off, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
We all pay our commitments.
So it's like Robert Kiyosaki says, you know, pay yourself first and then everyone else.
That's the basic principle.
Yep.
It was not new to him. That was said long before him. I said that long before he said it.
Sorry, I just got a problem. I won't mention him again.
No, that's all right. I don't mind. It's all good to learn things. It's great. Think about it, talk about it.
I think these principles have been around since the Romans, you know, or even before, since civilization. It's just that there's no formal way they're taught. If only, you know, it's not taught in high school.
The richest man of Babylon, remember, you know, the first thing is a part of all you earn is yours to keep. That's the first principle, the richest man of Babylon. So if you keep a part of what you earn, you can't get overdrawn. You won't fall for buy now, pay later. Then that grows, and you put that to work, and it grows and grows and grows, and it grows faster and faster. The trouble is it takes a while to get going, and that's why people give it up. Psychology. They want it right now. Instantaneous. Give me a tip. Oh, what's a good tip, Noel? I get it all the time.
All right, everybody done?
Yeah, that was amazing.
Done for now. That is amazing.
Thank you.
It's been nice to meet you guys virtually.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
How are you feeling about the year? We started this podcast to help you find ways to make your bigger dreams and the career you build around it fit with the life you want to live. Or if that's too ambitious, then at the very least, to make work not suck. And I personally thought that the answers to a fulfilling, happy career as a vet lay in personal growth and better workplaces and all of the other non-clinical stuff that we talk about. But something that surprised me when we started doing the clinical podcasts was how big a role that played in my personal enjoyment of work. And judging by the feedback we get from our listeners, it's a common occurrence. Here's why I think it is. It sucks to feel in the dark with your cases, to feel green or rusty in your knowledge. You feel guilty because you feel like you should know more and you should be learning more, but you're also trying to have a life outside of vet. So ongoing learning falls by the wayside. On the flip side, it's a really nice feeling to know your stuff. When you get that case, to know the answer. Or if there isn't an answer, to know that it's not because of your lack of knowledge. It's just one of those cases. Competence breeds confidence, and confidence is key. And our clinical podcast is the easiest way to work on your competence. Little bits of growth every week with minimal effort on your part. Try it. It works. Join our growing community of VetFelt nerds and get your mojo back at vvn.supercast.com.